Annexation number 11938, Real 6.
Mr. G. Eyston, Real 6. Can you tell me, Mr. Eyston, the situation immediately prior to your setting off into Belgium on or about May the 16th, 1940?
Well, we were certainly kept busy, you know, whether that was deliberate to keep us occupied or not, I'm not certain. But there was certainly a fact that we did a grenade practice the day before, and that was the first time that we'd ever used grenades. Major Jeffries was out there instructing. He knew all about them. The RSM had some idea of them, but actually it was the first time the bulk of men had seen grenades. And these were issued and went out about 6 miles away. I think we actually went into one of the tank traps that we'd been digging.
Did you take part in this practice?
No. I took Major Jeffries out and I won't say supervised, but he was there and certainly he was doing quite a lot of work about it. So we were kept busy, right, and the digging went on right until the last day. Again, on the night of the 15th, the heavy guns going through Emerong were really serious. There was no sleep again that night. And the following morning, I don't know what time we actually got on the move, but certainly must have been fairly early because we had a break at 11:45. The next break was 14:45. So if we take 3 hours, we'd probably be away at 8 o'clock or just after 8 o'clock. Timing was all important at this particular stage because I can't pass on to anybody how compacted the roads were. If you think that our column was 170 yards apart, each vehicle, that makes us something like 150 miles long. And we've got to fit in with the rest of the division, in fact with the rest of the BEF, who were all trying to move up at the same time. That is probably why we were so much later, 6 days late, in fact, in setting off from Emerin. The 2nd Battalion moved up on the 10th, but they were the forward troops. And we were reserve troops. So the timing was all important. As soon as we got off the road, somebody else was following in our wake and trying to get to the same place, more or less. There was difficulty in some places that Belgians in particular were fleeing, and they were crowding the road on the, I'm going to put this right, on the opposite side of the way we were travelling. We were driving on the right, so they were on the left, coming down.
Did you see a lot of this?
Quite a lot.
At this early stage?
At this early stage, there was quite a lot of it. Not immediately leaving Emerin, but later on, when we got into Belgium itself, as we went through Tournai, the people welcomed us in Tournai and were even throwing fruit and flowers at us, glad that the Tommy was going through. But not far past Tournai, on the Brussels Road, then we met the crowds coming in the opposite direction. In fact, if I can just mention these crowds again, at night, the night of the 16th, because the DRs were absolutely shattered, if you think that we're travelling at 12 and a half miles an hour on a bike, a motorbike, travelling at 12 and a half miles an hour is a difficult operation. Occasionally they would get a message and then they'd dash away down the column in the same direction as the refugees, which again was difficult for them. So at night the DRs were completely shattered, and there was a message to go to our 2nd Battalion, who were at the other side of Brussels. So I volunteered to take the message. I think it was a personal message from Major Jeffries to probably one of his own friends of the regiment. So I took this message through, and the Belgians were coming down, Belgian troops, Belgian refugees, carts, prams, anything with wheels that they could put their stuff on. And every now and again, some mad idiot would come down with a car on the outside. I can only describe him as one of today's yuppies. Of course, that's not going down very well in history, but today we have yuppies, and they are, I'm all right, Jack. It was an army expression, I'm all right, Jack. But today we've got yuppies, and I can only describe these people as yuppies. So twice they drove me in the ditch. There was nowhere else for me to go, because I was travelling on the right-hand side of the road. They were all coming down the left, and these yuppies would come flying down, taking the right-hand lane up as well. So twice they pushed me in the ditch. And to get a motorbike out of the ditch on your own is a very handy sort of thing to be doing. However, that's apart from the story of moving it to Belgium.
What reaction was yourself and those of the people around you to seeing these people, these refugees? Did you have any reaction to them?
From my own personal view, it was sickening. Women, children, kiddies in prams, women carrying the babies, occasionally being strapped, because the Germans weren't too fussy where the bullets went. No doubt they were trying to catch us, but they were being strapped and just dumped in the side of the ditch. We didn't have time to stop, because our programme was timed to the minute. And if you think of all these vehicles, I can't remember the number of vehicles now, but there's quite a lot of vehicles, stretched out along the road, and the refugees on the other side of the road, the Germans weren't too fussy, so quite a lot of them got hurt.
Were there any sights which made you particularly angry towards the Germans?
I don't think I was particularly angry, because we'd learned by then what war was about. We'd seen it happen in Poland. We hadn't seen it, but we'd heard or seen pictures of it happening in Poland, so we knew what war was about then, and we'd also heard about the Spanish War, which was the forerunner of the Second War. So, no, I wasn't particularly I was disturbed, if you can understand, but not angry. Not at that stage. Well, I was never really angry about it, because it was just a job. It was more like going to work, really. It was a job that we'd been taught to do, and we were going to do it to the best of our ability. So the Belgian people at Tournai, where we were passing through, I mean, they probably didn't have any idea how fast they were going to be taken over by the Germans. Nor did we. We didn't think. We had a good idea that we weren't going to hold them, because we had nothing to hold them with. When I did explain before that our personal anti-tank equipment was a .55 rifle, anti-tank rifle, which was more or less useless. Brigade only had a 1.5-pound anti-tank gun for the brigade, and there was no way that we were going to really, no matter how many men you've got, you can't stop tanks with pea shooters. You need something a little bit heavier. What I am puzzled about was what happened to all the heavy artillery that went into Belgium, because we didn't seem to see any signs of it, and a lot of this was 7.5 stuff, a lot of 25 pounders. I mean, we had as a division, we had three batteries of 25 pounders, plus three batteries of anti-tank, but we never saw them at all. Later, when we went into the attack, they were supposed to be with us, but I'll come to that later on. So the move to Belgium was really serious. Just going to the details of it, I've got the movement order, and it says that we'll go through Anquan and Uppland and Seklen, which were our battalion company places, where the companies had been. And we went through all these again, so we got a lot of bye-byes from the young ladies. From the young ladies as we went on that stage of it. And then we went further afield through Vaunville, Le Quin, Le Pavre, Charonde, Béziers, and into Tournai. And then, of course, into Belgium. Now, the route from Belgium was that the people there really thought a lot of the Tommy in Belgium, I think. And they were happy to see us. Tony, Renault, Nedda Brackel and Minove. That is on the main road to Brussels, the road I went along on the motorbike later on in the night. And from there we went into Moorn, Eidegem, which is west of Brussels, quite west on the which river is it on? I've forgotten.
Was this your objective? This is when you reach
this
the
is
end
where
of the
we're
journey.
The Dondre. Couldn't think for a minute there, just went. Which was on the Dondre. Now, an interesting thing happened here, as far as I was concerned, that we arrived in the Chateau grounds, and I dumped Major Jeffries off and put him in this chateau. Now, this got to me, because it was a marvellous chateau. And Major Jeffries was billeted in, I don't know, we'll say the chatelaine's room, probably a countess, but we'll say the chatelaine's room in any case. And all of her jewellery, her cosmetics, and everything were just left on her dressing table just as she walked out. Probably put a coat on her and walked out, because he did move very fast. And that really got to me, that people had to be thrown out of places like this, because being brought up on a fairly big estate, it did hurt. I mean, you drive through the gates and up this long drive, straight drive with trees on either side, then you hit the chateau with a great big circular road round up to the steps that went inside the chateau. So I got Major Jeffries installed in this. I went round to the back to see what the cooks were up to, save out some rations. Then I decided it was time that I had a pee, urinate. So I went into the woods and I saw some prisoners with a Lance Corporal RP digging a trench.
Were these German prisoners?
No, our own prisoners.
Men that had misbehaved in some way.
Yes, and they were digging this trench. A latrine it was, the proper latrine. I mean, the latrine was a trench with two posts on either end and a long pole over the top. You sat on the long pole over the top and hoped everything went inside the trench. However, these prisoners were still digging the trench. So I had a word with the Lance Corporal, asked him how I was getting on and so forth. And I walked away behind a tree, two or three trees away, and urinated. He came up and asked me what I was doing, promptly booked me for not urinating in the trench. I thought, well, that's a bit off when the lads were still down there digging their trench, and I couldn't see any difference between urinating against the tree and doing it down the trench, quite honestly. However, I got booked, and I got 3 days jankers the same night, because things were moving so fast, the company commander's orders were that night.
Did that mean anything?
Well, that was probably why I went to Brussels, quite honestly. I remember cleaning a few pans at the kitchen. And then I think, I don't know how it came around, but this thing came on to go to the other side of Brussels. So I went on the DR's bike and delivered the message. And that was the only thing I ever did as far as the 3 days confined to barracks went.
Going to Brussels, did you have a map of the area? Were you sure which way you were going?
I was pretty good with directions. I had a map, and I was pretty good with directions. And Major Jeffries was excellent. I don't think you'd find a better map reader anywhere in the British Army. I think I told you last time about one of the moves we did, where he missed a turning, yes. and he put us on the road without crossing the I mean, it's simple to go around a block and get back to where you want, but not Major Jeffries. He took us round, and we finished up going in the right direction without crossing the line of transport. Oh, he was excellent with a map, and if you got directions from him, you knew where you were going. There was no messing about.
Did you find 2nd Battalion, by the way?
Yes, yes.
What state were they in? Because they'd had some action.
They were in action. I didn't actually see any of their action that they were in. And I didn't have time to stop with them very long. I delivered my message, and I think I got a reply, and I brought it back. And in fact, I don't know whether it was the same night. It probably was the same night. The 2nd Battalion came through us. They passed through us on their way to their next defensive line. I should know where that was, but I can't. On the escort, I think. Escort? Yeah, I think it was the Dondra and then the escort. Anyway, they came through us and they were setting up a line behind us, which at that stage were going to leave us in the front line. It didn't, because on the 17th, that was the day after we landed, we started to load up and get ready for a movement. And we went off on the 17th, no, that's the escort. We went back to the escort, forced march 35 miles.
Before we go on to that, can you recall what happened with you on the Dondra, Dendra? Did you were you digging in? Or?
We dug in all night.
Were you expecting?
I didn't. I've got to be fair about this. I didn't do any digging. I had my own work looking after Major Jeffries and doing his errands mainly, or taking him wherever he wanted to be. And I didn't realise until just recently that, of course, he was a colonel at that time. He was a CO, because Colonel Miller was on leave in England with his batman and his driver. They were all in England.
So you'll be moving around with Major Jeffries that night within the battalion situation?
All night, and to brigade. In fact, I believe we went to division as well during that night, because the lag of instructions getting through from corps to division to brigade to battalion, it was decided that we'd go for one meeting to a division. I'm not too certain about this, but I'm nearly certain that one night we went to division to get instructions direct from the divisional commander rather than go through the next channel.
Did you realise, did the battalion realise that they were in the front at that time with the other troops moving through them?
We knew we were close.
And were you expecting it?
And I knew we were closer because I'd already been to the 2nd Battalion, which was a good distance, really. Possibly 20 miles. But the way things were going, 20 miles was no distance at all. It was an hour's, just an hour. So, yes, we knew by that that stage that we were more or less in the front line.
What was the mood then when you realised you were going to be pulled away without any kind of action at all? Was there any mood that was ever...
This, I can't really explain. There was disappointment. Because most of us realised that the whole purpose of the war was to stop what was happening. And I think in our narrow-minded sort of ways, we were kind of disappointed that this was happening. But when we look back, it just had to happen. There was nothing we could have done about it. We just didn't have the equipment or the organisation to have done anything about it. Of course, we didn't realise at that time that there'd be the breakthrough from at the end of the Maginot Line. We didn't know about that. At this stage, we thought we were just dropping back because we had no defences prepared in Belgium. The Belgium had their ideas of defences, but they certainly weren't ours. And a lot of us have thought for years now, well, for a lot of years, that had we stayed in France, the war would have been a different thing altogether. Whether it would or not, we don't really know, but if we do think that if we'd stayed in France, we had a better chance than going to Belgium. We knew that going to Belgium was upsetting all our strategies, you might say. We know there was a scheme that we went into Belgium if it was invaded, for all Belgium strictly said they were neutral. We knew that if anything did happen to Belgium, we knew we were going to go to Belgium. There was no mistaking that. We knew that we wouldn't let them go off completely. So there's some disappointment that we didn't make a stand for all when the second battalion came through and explained their difficulties. We knew that, although they hadn't had a great deal of losses at that time, the second battalion, they'd lost some, but they hadn't. It had been a planned withdrawal all the way through. But we were, yes, we're disappointed. I'm glad.
So the transport had gone, and in effect, the battalion marched back.
The transport had left us then. Of course, they were bringing supplies up.
You had your truck?
We had our own trucks, yes, our own battalion transport. But the RSC, the support, our transport platoon, they had gone.
How was that march made, and you know, what was your role in that march, or during that march?
The march from Adigem back to the ESCO. Well, Major Jeffrey set off marching with the troops. And I was put in a position, I suppose, I don't know where, he had a company with him. I think he had a company. And then I followed on behind that company with the company transport. Now, I don't know if you've driven for a day at 4 miles an hour or 3 miles an hour. It is the most tedious thing that could ever happen to anybody. I had good supplies of bullied beef because I had a good going with the cooks. And if I wanted anything, I just used to tell them, well, I'm going away for 2 or 3 days and can you give me something? And they were very, very good. They gave me any amount of bullion biscuits, no bother at all. So I'd be driving along with a tin of bully down by my side, and I'd be dipping my fingers in the bully and eating the bullies who went along, absolutely bored to tears. Occasionally we would get the odd plane coming over and the aircraft going up and one thing or another. Strafed a little bit and bombed a little bit, but nothing to mean anything, really. And I got, well, I don't know whether I got bored, but in the end, I asked somebody to drive it a little bit, and I would walk along, and these people were quite glad to see of their feet. And later in the course, we started picking people up, and I would go out and try and get in front. You must remember that this time we were now involved in the same direction as the refugees. We're all travelling in the same way. So
was that causing any complications?
Well, obviously we were travelling at, we were marching. We weren't, the refugees were slouching. We couldn't blame them. I mean, they weren't used to it at all. But we were marching, so we were keeping a steady pace. So that did cause some difficulties.
Was there any attempted road control? Were the road police around of any form? Or?
There were MPs. In fact, we sent a platoon to do control of refugees to try and keep them in some sort of an order. And what they tried to do was to keep them into the right-hand side of the road and let us march down the left-hand side. Am I right here? Yeah, down the left-hand side.
And this platoon was sent on ahead for a certain distance?
They were lined out along the route, trying to keep them in so we could march down on the opposite, in the opposite direction. Of course, if you met something, then you had a problem, you see, because even a company, it takes, or a platoon, you see, 30 men into a platoon, it takes a bit of space up.
Was there any comments between refugees and troops? They would know that you were retreating, and they were having been fought out of their homes. Was there any sign of any animosity between you as you went along?
I think they were just so dumbfounded, so dead, you might say, that they had nothing at all. Their own soldiers had already done this. They'd already gone. They were back in France, quite a lot of their soldiers. So there was no bitterness at all, as far as I could tell. They were just marching along, moving along with their heads down. They'd left everything. All they got was what they could carry. So, no, they were in no spirit to argue with us or anything.
Did you have stopping places for rest?
There we're on the march where you had 10 minutes in the hour. So you marched 50 minutes and then you had 10 minutes rest. I can't remember the cooks supplying anything on that route. It is possible that there was one stop where the cooks dished a meal. The system was really that the cooks went to a spot and prepared a meal. And then because the cooks had their own trucks, and each company cooks had their own cook's truck. And they had a 1,500 weight to carry their weapons. Each platoon had a 1,500 weight to carry their weapons. The company commander would have a PU, which was the same as mine, in most cases, a Morris Commercial 800 weight.
What's a PU?
PU is a public utility. It could be used for signals, or it could be used for personnel. Would carry six in the back, I think, and two in the front, so he carried eight. I suppose you'd get nine on a pinch, one sat on the floor, something like that. But it was also used as a wireless truck.
And all these vehicles were proceeding at marching pace?
At marching pace, apart from the cook's trucks, which had gone on. Now, I can't remember that the cooks did stop. It is possible that they went to a spot and prepared a meal, and then the troops would stop possibly for an hour to get a meal. But I don't think they did, quite honestly, because they weren't certain where they were going to stop.
What effect had this march on the men, particularly, for example, what was the weather like?
Beautiful. Too good.
And what effect?
For marching.
Exactly. What effect would that have on the men marching, if any?
I don't think the weather affected them much. We had quite a lot of foot sores. And that is when I started marching and let somebody else drive the truck for a spell, because he could drive more or less in one foot. You only need to do one gear and control the throttle and the brake, more or less. So by this time, I'd hutched everything up to the front of the truck, all our midges, jet, free gear, my own gear, and stored it as well as we could, and we were loading the back up with people who couldn't. Who got really past the marching stage, yes.
Did you have many stragglers and people falling out?
I don't think we left anybody. I couldn't say, because at this stage I was still forward of these situations. But, I mean, even from this one company, I filled my truck up. The one I was following, I'd filled mine up. And I suppose when the carriers came along rear headquarters, they would have some space where they could pick people up. And the empty truck, the fittest truck, was a 1,300 weight. That was generally the last vehicle of the lot. They could get one or two in, although they had quite a few fitters with them at that time. And the MO's truck, he had a 1,500 weight with stretchers in and all the rest of it for the real.
And what position in the column would he be at the end?
He, I think, was in battalion headquarters, which was... I think on the march back, we marched off with three companies forward, and then eight quarter company, and battalion headquarters was with headquarter company, and then the carriers and the mortars and one company at the rear. Stuck.
Was there any problem? You say the cooks, you can't recall where the cooks made a meal, but was there any problem with food, or were they carrying haversack rations?
Well, I think everybody has an emergency pack, which you're not allowed to use unless you've got an officer's instruction to use it. That was generally a tin which contained a bar of black chocolate, two biscuits, and some jam. That was it. But I think on top of that, most people, or most sections, had a supply of corned beef and biscuits. We were living on biscuits at this stage. There was no bread. We hadn't had any bread since we left going to Belgium. It was all biscuits. And the fruit and veg, they seemed to get hold of summer. Well, not fruit so much, but veg, they seemed to get hold of pretty well. And meat didn't seem a too bad supply. They used to manage to rustle up something once a day anyway. Breakfast, I can't remember. Breakfast, I'm afraid, I can't remember anything about it at all.